Hello and welcome to the next in the series, The Leadership Hikers. My name is Amar Raghani and I'm a retired GP from Sheffield. Together with my colleague, Dr. Joanna Bircher, who's a GP from Greater Manchester, we're talking with people mainly from primary care who have inspired us with their stories of what they care about and how they've helped to make life better for their communities. Joanna and I have written about what it takes to lead well in our book, The Leadership Hike, and this series is all about the people who do this. The people we call the Leadership Hikers. It's about what they've learned and through them, what we might learn too. So I'm really delighted to welcome the next of our hikers, Dr. Carrie Lunan, who is a GP who's worked with marginalised groups over many years. She's the current chair of the Scottish Deep End Project, comprising GPs working in the 100 most socioeconomically deprived communities in Scotland. And Carrie was the past chair of the RCGP in Scotland. She currently works as Senior Medical Advisor on Health Inequalities to the Scottish Government. So, Carrie, hi and welcome.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much. Carrie, it's clear from the introduction that I just read there that when it comes to people marginalised by society and by the health service, caring about those people really runs through you like a stick of rock. Can you tell us something about what drives you and the journey that this has led you on?
I think about this a lot. I think about, you know, where that desire came from, whether it was part of my upbringing. I think I had an upbringing that was quite orientated towards social justice. And when I studied medicine, I wanted to find a home within medicine that allowed me to do more than just deliver healthcare. So I think that was one of the things that really attracted me to a career in general practice, where I could be embedded in communities and really get in about the issues of the day, that not just medicine, but the social issues of the day. Throughout my career, I've worked as a GP for about 20 years, but for 15 years of those, the most recent 15 years, I've worked with very marginalised groups, including for 5 years working within the homeless practice in Edinburgh. It motivates me more than any other type of medicine, I think, to be thinking about where the NHS really needs to be at its best, and where it's needed most, so that the health inequalities that we see on a day-to-day basis as a GP don't worsen.
I'm just interested because we're all moved by different things, and I know that, you know, the concept of health inequalities is widely accepted or universally accepted, but I wondered what really moved you, about those people and their plight.
In honesty, I began to become frustrated after my GP training about a lot of the space in the system being used up by people who didn't necessarily need to be in the system. And a lot of the space that did need to be taken up by people who did need it, I just didn't hear from. So there's a really useful phrase, I think, that I heard quite early on in my career about the unworried unwell. Often the people that we don't hear from, the people that are missing from our consulting rooms, often the people that serially miss appointments, are often the people that we really need to be hearing from. And I think I began to become frustrated as an NHS GP, doing the kind of medicine that felt like it wasn't really reaching the people that it needed to reach the most. That took a few years for me to realise that. And that's what, I guess, largely drove me to work in a different kind of healthcare setting. Was just thinking, what is the best use of my skill? What is the best use of my voice? Advocating on behalf of people who have no voice. So I think it was something about recognising that often, I think our healthcare systems are designed by healthy people, for use by healthy people, and often the people that really need to be accessing and utilising healthcare are those that really struggle to get there.
So that's really interesting. So it was beyond, if you like, notionally what we as doctors, for those of us who are doctors listening to this, what we're trained to do, you know, look after a general patient population. But you got a handle on that part of it that really bothered you. So I get that you felt that personally, and I'm wondering what it was, who it was that helped to fan that flame, if you like, and make that more of a central part of what you wanted to do.
I think I was lucky to meet reasonably early on in my career role models who practice medicine in quite a different way, who weren't afraid necessarily to shy away from politics, weren't necessarily afraid to shy away from lobbying, from advocacy, from doing a lot of the things that I now consider a really important part of my job, but had no experience of whatsoever during GP training or undergraduate training. And I saw that as you say, bigger than medicine, and actually a way that you can bring a lot of joy back into your job. I think when you're often when you're feeling a bit overwhelmed or a bit stressed, or that you have no control or sense of autonomy over the jobs that we're doing. And I think we all feel like that often in the NHS when it feels busy and intense, is that when you kind of hover above it or take a step back and think about what are the things that I do have control over? Whose lives am I able to influence because of the training I've got or the privilege I've got or the experience I've got? I saw other people doing it and I saw the energy and the passion that it brought to them. And I was inspired by them and I wanted to learn from them. So I guess I watched them. I observed what it was that they did, how they influenced. Sometimes it was in a good way and sometimes it wasn't necessarily in a way that I would have chosen to do. But I think I also learned probably more from patients than I did from medical school, because I think especially when I was working in the homeless practice, I felt completely unprepared for that kind of work when I started working there. I thought none of the medical training that has taken me up to this point is really helping me that much on a day to day, because this is a completely different kind of medicine. I need very different skills. I need to be able to prioritize different things, to listen in a different way. So I really had to kind of take a step back and learn from people who'd done it for a lot longer than me. And so I you know, came into contact with some very inspiring doctors and other clinicians and non-clinicians at that part of my career. And I think that's probably what helped me more than anything else.
I've heard people talk before about how useful or important it is to find your tribe, as people sometimes describe it, you know, people who can augment your sense of meaning and purpose. What did your tribe do for you that helped you to move in this direction?
One really important thing for me is finding a group of people who have a similar experience and a similar understanding, because being able to build that sort of community of practice where you've got people that speak the same language, that listen to the same kind of stories, that have the same day-to-day struggles in their clinical practice, that are finding it hard, that are struggling to find a way through, that have got things that you can share and learn from, I think feels incredibly important. You know, the Deep End project over the years has provided that sense of identity, I guess, and a sense of kind of collective voice and a feeling of, you know, pride around what we do, which, and that sense of sort of mastery and purpose, which all of which feels really important, I think, particularly when you're doing work that feels hard and challenging. Very rewarding. Absolutely. But hard.
You've mentioned there, Carrie, that you know, if I can paraphrase, you've developed relationships with the people that you are working with, this team on the Deep End. I want to move on a little bit, because you've had experience that many people listening to this podcast have not had. You've led the Deep End project. You've worked in an institution, heading up the RCGP in Scotland. You're now moving on to government. So contexts that are progressively bigger than what we are mostly used to working in our teams at practice level. Most of us are used to the importance of relationships and building relationships in the team, smallish teams, with people that we generally can get to know. But as I've described, it can't have been that straightforward for you with these bigger organizations and so on that you were leading. Can you share something about the challenges of developing relationships in those wider contexts beyond practice life?
Relationships are fundamental to making any kind of progress within any kind of work that we do. And they are really important to me. I know that not in my personal life, but also in my professional life. I've started in many kind of roles where I've taken them on and been aware that relationships have not necessarily been in a place where I've wanted them to be, and they felt quite difficult. And so when I have been aware of taking on a job in that context, I think I almost give myself permission to spend the first few weeks and months just listening to understand what it is that's upsetting, distressing, angering people, rather than listening to respond. And that's something I've had to work quite hard on over the years, because I tend to have the type of brain that formulates thoughts quite quickly. And so I've had to learn to hold that thought and listen to understand. If there's a way to be able to find language of collaboration, so that if you're able to find common ground, even if that area of common ground is really small between two, you know, groups of people who maybe sit quite far apart, if you can find one area of common ground and you can then cultivate that ground to make it more fertile and make it bigger, I think that's the start. So finding where you can work together on issues is a really good way of then kind of investing in the future for when you can't work together on issues, because there will be times, obviously, when you have to disagree. But if you can disagree with people that you have to be able to continue to work with, either within or out with your organisation, and you can do that in the context of a relationship that feels healthy and feels respectful, then you're far more able, I think, to be able to make progress without damaging those relationships, and being able to be a critical friend without undermining all the work that you've done before. So I guess some of it is about being aware of what the relationships are like when you come into an organization. I'll quite often, that will be one of the first questions I will ask someone, is what are relationships like? Because that's not what you get told in a job interview, and that's not what is described in a job description. And you often only really get a feel for that when you start working and you think, this feels difficult. There's something going on in this room or in this virtual space that feels quite challenging, and I'm not entirely sure what that is. And I think that's quite hard in the current world that we live in and work in, because we're working in digital spaces, and it's harder to read the room across a screen than it is across a table, because you can't, you know, often people don't have their cameras on and you can't read their expressions, or you can't have the kind of informal discussions on the way into and the way out of meetings about how did that feel for you? I'm not sure how that landed. You seemed upset at that point. Did I understand you correctly when you said X, Y, and Z? I really miss all of that informal sense checking that goes on out with that space. For me, I will try and use every mechanism that I can, whether it's informal or formal, asking the questions, looking for the common ground, trying to read the room in terms of building relationships with people, because that feels like the essence of everything that we do.
So you've touched on something interesting there in the sense that you were describing how things are difficult, challenging in the modern world. And talking to people currently in primary care, it feels as though it's becoming quite a toxic environment. People increasingly performance managed. And if you like, I'm generalizing here, we may feel that actually relationships are not valued as much as we feel they should be or they used to be. These are just suppositions. I just wondered about your experience actually of institutions and so on. Do you find that actually relationships, when they're explained, are valued, are nurtured and supported in the way that you would like them to be? I don't know. What's been your experience?
Explicitly, relationships are valued, and implicitly, they're often not, has been my experience. So then you experience a rub. So the organisation will probably have a strap line that includes in it that they value their people. But I don't know if that's actually how people feel. And I think as organisations become more under stress, they start to exert control on the people within the organisation, because it's a way of managing the stress of the organisation. So when things start to go wrong, and people start to become performance managed as a result of things going wrong, I think that's usually the wrong way to deal with things. I think the better way to deal with things is to try and understand why things are going wrong. And often it's because people don't have enough time to do the jobs that they want to be able to do. They don't feel listened to. They don't have a support structure where they can raise concerns. They don't feel valued. They don't feel motivated. Therefore, maybe their performance starts to drop off. So simply imposing targets and strap lines and speaking the speak, but not not actually doing what you say you think is important creates this rub within organizations where people, I think, just start to feel really demotivated. So I think the best organizations are the brave ones that are able to look internally and say, well, we say we value relationships, but what are we actually doing to sustain relationships within our organization? Mm. How are we creating space and time for people to come together and learn? How are we creating space and time for people to acknowledge when they've made a mistake and learn from those mistakes? How are we creating, you know, space and time for, in primary care in particular, new teams to come together that previously never worked with each other? So we don't have a good understanding of each other's roles and remits and each other's challenges to work in a way that feels productive and enjoyable, rather than fragmented and divisive. So I think that without all these supporting factors around it, relationships can't flourish. And that's what I think we need to be focusing on more, because if we don't have healthy relationships within our healthcare system, then we can't deliver high quality care. I fundamentally believe that. I don't think we can do that. And relationships with patients, similarly, how do we sustain and create good relationships with patients? Well, for me, it's all about trust. I don't think you can have relationships with either colleagues or with patients if you've not got the fundamentals there, which is, you know, where people feel like they can say things that are difficult, that that will be held, that that will be treated in a respectful way, and that trust can be built. And I think it's difficult to create relationships of trust when you're time pressured, where you've got targets imposed on you, and where, as well, something else that I've been increasingly interested in over the years, where there's no explicit understanding of some of the really challenging consultations and relationships that can occur, particularly in very deprived settings of healthcare, because mm-hmm. we are caring for people who have suffered significant adversity and who have really problematic relationships with trust, because it's never something that they've really been able to form in any caring relationship. So, you know, we come in as the caregivers and we try to offer healthcare to people who've never been able to receive healthcare because relationships of trust have not been there. And then we don't understand why it then becomes very dysfunctional within that consultation. So if we don't understand why, as clinicians, then we start to feel negative about it. We feel hopeless. We feel overwhelmed. We might start to become punitive and start to speak about people as being non-engagers or, you know, mm-hmm. DNA, recurrent people who recurrently DNA, rather than thinking about what are the underlying drivers within the relationship that is or is not happening in that room. And that, again, that is something that is completely missing from our current modern healthcare, is having those types of systems in place that allow us to sit with someone who is skilled in understanding relationships to say, why did that consultation make me feel really angry? Why did it make me feel really negative? Why did it make me feel abusive? Why did it make me feel hatred? All these really negative feelings that sometimes we can be left with after a really difficult consultation that we just currently have to park and move on to the next one. And I think, you know, if we were able to create conditions where we thought about these things more, that it not only improves our relationships with patients and our ability to stay compassionate in really difficult situations, but mm-hmm. it also improves our relationships with our colleagues, because we start to think about those dysfunctional relationships in the same way. We start to think, why does this feel difficult? What needs are being expressed here? What are the unsaid things, and how can I respond in a different way? So it's all, I think the learning is across all relationships.
It's fascinating. So you've talked a lot there about the nature of patient care and how that informs and is informed by developing the relationship. Relating better to people helps to influence things for the better, and you've described that beautifully in what you've just said about patient care. I wonder how that has helped to inform your abilities as a leader to persuade people with power and influence to change the system for the better. Is there anything that you can share with us on how to influence better? I'm thinking here about people who are moving from just practice life to maybe working in networks and bigger contexts and so on. Any thoughts on that? Clearly, relationship is at the heart of it. Is there more?
Often when I'm trying to influence. I will compare it to a challenging consultation. So, you know, going right back to basics. So, you know, if I feel that we're coming at a similar topic from quite different extremes, I think, you know, seeking to understand and asking some open questions about what is it that's worrying you about this? Help me understand what your concerns are about what I'm suggesting so that people can feel heard. And then checking that you've understood what they've said. So again, a lot of that is just simple consultation techniques that we learn. And I think, you know, so I think being able to connect at that really basic level can be really helpful. But also I think it's more powerful to be able to influence if we can bring in stories and bring in narrative about what it means on the front line of healthcare. And I'm talking, I guess, about roles that I've been in at a national level where you're maybe trying to influence politicians or policymakers mm-hmm. about why it's important to resource healthcare, resource primary care, resource areas of high health need, deprived areas, for example. So data is useful. And I think it's always useful to have good data up your sleeve that is fact-checked. But data isn't, I guess, my natural ally. I find data harder than I find stories. So I think useful to have data, but really, really useful to be able to bring in patient narratives, because that brings it to life in a way that data never can. And I think just kind of reminding ourselves that at the heart of everything that we're trying to do, it's about trying to improve care. It's about trying to improve experiences for patients, particularly patients with the highest health needs, rather than kind of lobbying too strongly about the things that can feel a bit further removed. That's why I think I probably wouldn't be a very good negotiator for the BMA, for example. I don't think I would be good at negotiating for terms and conditions in the same way that I would be good at negotiating for addressing health inequalities. I think I find it easier to influence when I'm talking on behalf of someone else.
And clearly talking about something that you care deeply about. So I'm not suggesting what the BMA do is not something you're interested in.
Not at all.
Throughout this conversation, no. You've been talking about what moves and motivates you. That's been great, Carrie. Now, most of our listeners will be interested in helping their communities to make a difference, but many of them will be inexperienced as leaders. Can you share some tips with them about taking their first steps in leadership? What are your thoughts on that?
Leadership for me as a word has always felt like quite a difficult word. And not necessarily a word that I would align with. I guess because it's maybe traditionally had a certain label attached to it, but I guess I would say, particularly to people starting out in their career, is that leadership happens at so many different levels. You know, it happens in the consulting room during a conversation with a patient. It happens when you're speaking to the members of your team. It happens when you're speaking with colleagues. It happens when you're speaking, you know, at local level, at health board level, at health authority level, at national level. So it happens at every level, every time that we role model in a positive way, every time that we speak out about something that we feel is important, every time that we try to influence change and try to make things better for the people that we're looking after. So I think just trying out simple things and gaining confidence, and also I guess watching people that you feel do it well and thinking, what is it about what they do that seems to work and that I feel comfortable with in terms of their style? So I think observing people that seem to do it well, I think trying it out is good. But I think also not believing that leadership is something that is quite lofty and inaccessible, because it's not.
Yes.
It's something that I think we all do in our jobs as doctors every single day, and maybe just reframing the way that we think about it so that it feels like it's something that we can all do in our jobs every day.
Absolutely. And we know each other a little, and I know talking to you today that you are not someone who sees themselves as being special or different from anyone else, but someone who is trying to do what matters. And for that, we thank you. You've given us a lot to think about today. Thank you so much for your time, Carrie.
Thank you.
Well, how do you feel after listening to Carrie? It's clear to me that Carrie is a people person. I think we all saw that. And we might say that all effective leaders in healthcare are. Carrie points out that people really matter and they are at the heart of changing things for the better, both at practice level and I guess at any level beyond, which is why developing and using relationships, as she was describing, she mentioned using the stories of those people that suffer. Those things are key to having an influence, not just at practice level in our sort of clinical contacts with patients and helping them to change their lives for the better. But actually, those same things help people to change systems for the better. We have those skills as clinicians. We use those skills every day in our consultation. They are at the centre of what makes us more effective leaders in other contexts as well. And also, finding what you care about is really important. We touched on the fact that we may be trained in our own disciplines, but actually finding what it is within that discipline that moves us, just as Carrie described, people who don't have a fair crack of the whip, people who are marginalised by society, that really moves her in a way that drives her to do something about it. That's something we can look for in our own lives, in our own circumstances, and be guided by that too. And, you know, with everything that Carrie's done at national level, it's easy for us to think of her as being somehow a different breed. But, you know, she isn't. Like us, she cares about what matters. But to me, here's the hard bit. She's able to put herself to one side. And it's interesting, isn't it, that Carrie hardly talked about her own insecurities or her own needs at all. Believe me, she has her own insecurities and her needs. But it's interesting they didn't dominate what she was talking about. All of us listening to this podcast are able to lead because leadership means something very simple. It means doing what matters. And to do it, as Carrie's story shows, we don't need to believe we are capable. We just have to accept it. Because if we keep seeking to believe we have what it takes, our leadership efforts are distracted because we keep looking for reassurance about ourselves. Like Carrie, we have what it takes. We now need to look for what we think needs to be done and to be led by that within our practice and who knows how far beyond. So it just remains for me to thank Carrie once again for sharing her insights and to thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please tell your friends and we look forward very much to welcoming you again to the next in our series of the Leadership Hikers.